join us on The Path Radio Mix online. And to get there, type in thepathradio.com. That's thepathradio.com. And enjoy free streaming music all day long. That's it. thepathradio.com. All right, now let's get to the main show, the monthly social podcast with me, your host, Guido Perino, as you go on with Guido. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the 2021 March edition of Guido's podcast. I have a really full show for you today. I'm really excited about the guests and the topics. We're going to talk with Jason Gauthier, the chief of the Missinabe Cree First Nation. We've also got Renata Solsky on tap to talk to us about her experience having contracted COVID-19. We're going to hear from musical guests, Johnson's Creek Band, a South Central Ontario musical act. And then we're going to talk about who stole the blue Smarties. Can't wait till you hear that one. All right, folks, hope you enjoy it. Let's get going. All right, before we get started today, I wanted to tell you a little bit about one of our Promote Ontario / Canada small businesses. One of today's show sponsors is Legault's Labels. Legault's Labels offers a wide variety of custom-made apparel and personalized home decor items, such as shirts, hoodies, hats, as well as car decals, wall decals, mugs, display tiles, keychains, and so much more. They work hard in ensuring the quality of each and every product is made with a great deal of attention, lots of love, and care. They're located out of Windsor, Ontario. They're run by a husband and wife team. They can be reached through their Facebook page at www.facebook.com/Legault's Labels. The link will be available in our podcast notes. Please check them out. So our main guest today is Jason Gauthier, who is the chief for the Missinabe Cree First Nation. And in our chat, we're going to cover off how exactly he became chief and the story that goes with that and the credentials. We're going to talk a little bit about resource sharing and how that has impacted the Indigenous people with some of the land agreements that have been made in Ontario. We're also going to get into a discussion of what challenges he has seen as chief. And overall, we cover off some culture, social, and economic advancements for Indigenous people. So have a listen and enjoy. All right, I am here with Jason Gauthier, who is the chief of the Missinabe Cree First Nation tribe. Did I get that right, Jason?
Yeah, that's we don't really call ourselves tribes here in Canada. We're more First Nation, just First Nation. But tribe is a common use of in the States.
So see that, I didn't even make it through the first 15 seconds, eh? And
No,
I'm kidding.
We're here to learn, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. That's the whole premise of what I do with the podcast. It is to educate everybody who wants to listen. And in the process, I end up educating myself. Listen, you and I, we go back to some high school days at St. Mary's College in Sault Ste. Marie. Specifically drama class. You remember our drama class days?
Yeah, I do. I think that, we got to, perform, I guess, in it wasn't all book work, and we got to get on stage and do some improv, and we had a lot of fun. I think, it gave the opportunity for a lot of students to sort of open up and enjoy themselves.
Yeah, and before I hit the record button, we were kind of reminiscing a little bit. We were talking about how there were so many different personalities in that class, and the teacher, she had the ability just to, back then, to really just bring us together. And I always look back at that class and I think it was one of my first experiences, whether I knew it at the time or not. I felt, anyways, we didn't have any barriers between us as participants, eh?
Mm-hmm.
I've been reading through a little bit of your bio, and you've got a lot going on, like, holy jumping. You did an honors degree in sociology, and you're a certified computer technician. And I thought, I got to tell you, I thought those two things were kind of interesting, because I don't know if you know this, I actually went to university as well, and I started in with the intent of finishing sociology. I ended up doing a BA, but with a very heavy focus on sociology. And I left so that I could go and pursue a computer engineering technologist diploma. So,
it's certainly the opposite of what I did.
Yo, you did it the other way around?
Yeah, I got my my computer technician certification, and then I went to university later to sociology, and that's when I got a honors degree in sociology with a certification in social welfare.
Isn't that neat, eh? Just like we kind of went to, you know, similar sort of paths, just in a different way, right? And I just thought that was kind of neat too when I was going through that. But you've got other stuff going on. Like I see here, you know, you've done some work with Algoma University, Ryerson University. This is really neat too. You were interim grand chief of the Mushkegowak Tribal Council.
Yeah,
did I say that right?
You did.
Hey, I've redeemed myself. Right on. And then it says, you know, you're land use planner manager for tribal council as well. So you've really got a wide spectrum of experience over the course of your career, eh?
Well, I think I started off a little bit slow. I mean, I didn't start, I didn't get to university until I was a little bit older. And by the time I finished university, I had a lot of work to do. So, I mean, I did some short contracts, and I did some work with I did some work with First Nation with computers prior to going to university. I did some work with the chief of the First Nation at the time in mining as his assistant for a couple of years, and then I ran for council. So the process for running for council and a council person is a little bit different than the chief. The chief. The council person is sort of the governing body who makes decisions on behalf of the First Nation, and they're all elected. So there was an election. I wasn't young, but I put my hat into to run for the council of our First Nation, and out of five councillors and one chief, I came fifth the councillors. It was the first time I'd ever ran for any political office, and I was quite proud that I was able to get into council on the first shot. And it was surreal when I first got in.
That sounds like a cool process, but so that's different than chief.
It is different than chief in the way that, you know, I'm competing against 16 different people, and to get into a spot of five to help direct the community, the rest of the council, and help the chief perform his duties. From there, the incumbent chief didn't run another term. You know, I was asked by some elders to run for the position, and then I ran in 2013. I was successful in 2013 getting in as the chief of the First Nation by 6 votes. So it was very, very close. It was a very polarized, divided community at the time. And then I was asked to run again in 2016 and 2019, which there was quite a margin the second and third time I got in. So I guess it was in some ways it was an acknowledgement that I was doing something right.
So how did you, I mean, you've given a little bit of history in terms of there were some conversations happening, you got some experience. Did you at some point before that say, hey, and this is, we're sort of blending question one, because usually question one I ask folks, hey, give us an idea of how you got to where you are, so that other people can relate and understand, you know, what the process is. But at some point before that, did you say, I want to be the chief of the Missinabe? Or did it just sort of naturally unfold that way as you started working and learning and getting to know people?
No, I think that there's a different process for running for council and running for chief. And like I said before, I think that when I ran for council, I think there were certain things that I wanted to do before I ran for council. And one of them is I wanted to go back to university. I was asked if I would run in 2006, and I said, you know, I didn't feel that that was appropriate because I didn't feel that that it was a I was prepared for it. So I went to university. I got a degree, and then I felt that by 2010 I was ready to run for a counselor position. So the natural progression from a counselor is if you feel, you know, if you're on council, you feel that you want to, you know, move into that. You have some experience in governance. You have some experience if you feel you don't have to do it this way, but it's always recommended that you have at least some experience before getting into the chief position. So I did a term of 3 years on council and made a decision. Like I said, there were elders who had asked me to run for the chief position, and I talked to my wife at the time, and I said, you know, this is a big commitment. What do you think? And we decided to run, because I really feel that, you know, without the support of my wife, I wouldn't be able to do the job. So I think
good planning there, Jason. So it sounds like that, you know, what I'm hearing is, you know, there was a period of a lot of self-reflection in terms of, you know, what you wanted to do personally before you kind of took this on. And I know you mentioned elders earlier when we first started talking. You spoke to your wife. Was there advice from elders as part of this process as well? Or
yeah, I think that, like I said, there was a question that came forward from the elders. They felt that I was in a position, and I think it's always, you know, what they want in a community leader is somebody that's, you know, following a path that they feel is healthy or you know, that they feel is advantageous for our community. So they come to you, they ask you, you know, do you feel like being in that position? You know, what do you feel about it? And, you know, it's almost like you're being asked to serve, right? So it's not really a position of power. It's more of a position of servitude.
Servitude. I like that word. So Jason, now you're chief, is there a term to this or is there a self term to this or, what do you do after this or how long do you do this for?
So we have an election code, and it was originally passed down to us from Indian Affairs. We redeveloped the code so that it was a custom code. So we put that to the membership for ratification. They agreed that it looked like something that we should, you know, follow as far as process. And then in that process, it shows that I can run. The election is every 3 years, and I can run in perpetuity.
Oh, do chiefs normally do that, or? Or what is there any pattern to it at all in the past?
Well, I know we've had a pattern in we've had our we had a first chief. His name is John Fletcher. He ran as our first chief back in the early 90s. The former chancellor of Algoma University, Shirley Horn, she did two terms. Glenn Nolan, he did three terms of 3 years, and then Kim Rainville did one term, wow. And then this is my third term.
Wow. So that's kind of neat. It's kind of neat. It's neat that you can carve it out, and I think it's kind of neat that you definitely seem to have some control over your path when it comes to this part of the journey. I want to I want to shift a little bit. I had asked you about the land acknowledgement, and I just want to take a moment to read it. You provided me with the land acknowledgement. It says, "We acknowledge that we are on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabeg and Métis Nations, including Batchewana First Nation, Garden River First Nation, and the historic Sault Ste. Marie Métis Council, as well as the land that is host to Missinaabe Cree First Nation." The land acknowledgement has been something new to me the last couple of years. And as we sort of learn more about it, and I said to you before we hit the record button, you and I kind of chatted a bit, and I said, you know, we talk about things today that growing up we never talked about, but when it comes to this land acknowledgement, what does it mean to you, or what does it mean to the Missinaabe, or if you can, what does it mean to Indigenous people in general to hear that we're doing that or saying those words or participating or learning about it?
Well, it's a good question when you talk about, like you said, a cross-section of time, when we talk about, you know, how what we did when we were in high school back in the 80s and what we're doing now. I think that the land acknowledgement, specifically this land acknowledgement, is very interesting because we went through a process of getting our reserve up in the Missinaabe area, and a lot of us are spread out because we didn't get our reserve until 2018. So, I mean, we acknowledge that we're not really in our traditional territory, and we want to acknowledge. And again, like you said, it's really a sign of respect for the First Nations that we stand on the bones of their ancestors. I mean, they've been here 15,000, or I should say, you know, time immemorial. We don't know how long we've been here and how long they've been here. So we acknowledge that, you know, their history is here. Our history is not here, but we share it with them, and they have been gracious enough to share that with us. So as far as general Indigenous people, I think that's basically what it is. It's sometimes considered a protocol, but most of the time it's considered a sign of respect.
So you mentioned 2018. I was going to ask you this a bit later, but you mentioned 2018. Now, I know that back in 2018, I'm going to ask you now, there were some landmark agreements around resource sharing with the province of Ontario in terms of mining and forestry, and maybe there was some other things. I was trying to do some reading and understanding about this, but I'm sure you'll correct me or give me more information if you have it. Has there been additional movement, and what does that mean for, again, what does it mean for the Missinaabe or Indigenous in general when we're talking about the resource sharing with the province? What does that do?
So what happened in 2000? I think it was 2017. I was asked by I was asked to a meeting with ministers, with the Minister of Natural Resources and Forestry, and at the time Ministry of Northern Development and Mining.
Yeah.
And I think they were looking for some of the articles of the United Nations Rights of Indigenous Peoples document, and you know, there was recommendations in there about resource revenue sharing and how we're going to be able to work together as a province and as First Nations people. So they had some work to do. So, I mean, the mandate from at the time was Kathleen Wynne, and she wanted to put something together prior to the election. She knew she wasn't doing very well in polls, and she really wanted to work with First Nations that would actually get to a resource revenue sharing model for the taxation on resources that they're getting, you know, from the resource companies. So they asked us if it's possible that I and Grand Council Treaty 3, I shouldn't say I, it's Meshkagwik at the time. Meshkagwik asked me to become the lead negotiator on resource revenue sharing, which had been attempted twice before. We were successful on a small scale, but they asked the entire Chiefs of Ontario, 133 First Nations, on a resource revenue sharing model, and it failed. So they decided to go to some of the tribal councils, which is a smaller sort of carrying capacity. So we we decided that you know, that we can do it, that it was possible. So they wanted to do it in 6 months before the writ dropped. So I had to be, I was negotiating probably maybe 3 days every 2 weeks for 6 months, which I really didn't have the time to do, but it was important. I felt it was important, and the community backed me to make sure that this was completed. And we got a landmark agreement with the province on resource revenue sharing that was a better deal than any other province, I think. You know, if you look at the numbers themselves, it's probably the best agreement in Canada as far as resource revenue sharing goes with the province. And we completed and signed that deal one day before the writ dropped and the election started. So it was right down to the wire, and I'm very proud of the fact that we were able to. There was a team of maybe 12 people on both sides of the table, and everybody did their part, and we got it completed. And as the lead negotiator, it was a very intense negotiation, and I learned a lot about negotiation at that
time. So Jason, what for folks listening, what does resource revenue sharing actually do for you, though? What do you get from that agreement?
Okay, so what happens is any taxation that is on the forestry, any new mining and any original mines that the Ontario government gets from these mines and from all the forestry companies, a portion of that and a significant portion of that goes to Mishkegwa Council, and then it is divided to each of the First Nations. So I'm not saying it's billions of dollars or anything like that, but there is a significant chunk of money that comes to each right. First Nation because of resource sharing.
And it's revenue that didn't exist before that you can use, right?
That's correct. Yeah. There are some stipulations to the funding, but they're very wide open, and it can be used for a lot of different things for the advantage of our First Nations.
Is there opportunity for additional conversations? Like, are you, you mentioned that, you know, the mining and the forestry, is there other opportunities still in the wing, so to speak?
Yeah, what we decided is we would do a 5-year pilot project. And in the new project, we did say that we would talk about things like aggregates. And, you know, we've recently wanted to talk a little bit more about energy and energy consumption, dams and stuff like that in our territory also. So it's an ongoing conversation, and we've touched base with the Ontario government several times to say, you know, look, you know, we're going to be knocking on the door pretty soon. This is our third year in, you know, what are we looking at?
So it sounds like with movements like this, that there is significant change. If I take a step back before I went into this question, I was going to ask you, have things changed for Indigenous people from, let's say, when you and I were kids, or even from when you and I were in high school to today? Are they still facing the same challenges, or what is it? What is at the root of the change? And this isn't, you know, there's a couple of pieces to this, Jason. There's you know, culturally, socially, economically, I'm probably missing some of the clees there, but I think you get to where I'm heading with this. You've got some of these agreements in place, but are you noticing a more totality of change?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I mean, again, high school is a different thing, right? Like I remember when I was a kid thinking, you know, listening to people like, Ovid Mecredi, some of the grand chiefs right. of the day, you know, and listening to, you know, what they had to say way back then. And you know, we had our own regional chiefs and we had our own regional, I mean, it's nothing I really, you know, felt comfortable having conversations with people, you know, at school, but maybe you know, there was a space for that, but I didn't see it at that time. You know, I never got into, you know, First Nation politics in a school that I didn't feel was, you know, our school wasn't all that open to Indigenous knowledge and discussion. But you know, I don't belabor on that kind of stuff, and I don't worry about it today. I know that I had a significant advantage in some ways. I hate to call it advantage, but you know, I wasn't as visibly First Nation as others were. Mm-hmm. And we see challenges with others that were clearly a lot darker skinned and a lot, you know, had more visible traits of being
so,
First Nations.
So has that, have you now having a sort of a different view on that today, has that changed?
Well, I'm not colorblind, right? I see people, you know, for their cultures, but I think I've spent the time in university to sort of understand that a little more than before I went. So I mean that's a process of like you said, you know, self-discovery and it's really understanding and being able to critically think about your environment, right? So I think now I understand some of the stuff I didn't understand then, but you know, I think that I don't. Everybody had that same lack of knowledge, right? Lack of education on what First Nations were back then and how they affected, and you know, the Sault Ste. Marie as a whole and the world. And
yeah, well,
we never really knew, right?
There was probably a couple of things. One was either a lack of knowledge, and then the other one was just, I guess, ignorance too, right? I mean, it's hard to look back, I guess, all those years ago. I just do it in retrospect, and I say, you know, I'm imposing, you know, what I perceive to be change, but what I don't know, because I'm not at the grassroots of it, is did the conversation change, and through some of these agreements, has that had a positive impact on Indigenous people overall?
Well, I think there's more recognition, though. I mean, I think that people understand a little bit more. People are starting to understand a little bit more the jurisdiction of the First Nations, too, right? And the lands and the way they understand land. And I think there's more conversation than there has been in the past. And I think people were afraid to have those conversations when we were kids. And now we're not afraid to have those conversations. We've sort of grown this newfound, I shouldn't say newfound, but I should say we have this pride about being, you know, First Nations. And mm-hmm. I think that that we can have those conversations now openly without worrying about you know, repercussions or you know, I say, you know, instead of ignorance, I mean, some are ignorant, some are arrogant, right? You know, some people do it with intent, some people just don't know any better. And I know I spend a lot of time now, I'm a significant part of the Marconi Club now, in Sault Ste. Marie here, and it's primarily Italian. And a lot of the people that I work with, the owners and the management group there, they are, they ask me all the time different questions about, you know, First Nations and what it is to be First Nations. So they're listening, is what I'm saying, and they're asking.
That's neat. You know what? I think that when you're being heard, maybe that's the difference maker, when you're being heard, right? Listen, what is the most challenging thing that you've had to do as chief? Is there anything you share with us? Like, is that, given your role and all your knowledge and your tenure there, can you share with us what one of the most challenging things you've had to do?
Well, I think, you know, I don't think I have anything too profound to say about it, except for the fact that, you know, family is important, and you know, I think the hardest thing is being away from family. I think that, you know, I have children that miss me when I'm gone, and I know I have to be places, and I know I have to, you know, push the envelope. I know, you know, we have some significant negotiations that have to be done, and they're never in Sault Ste. Marie. They're in Toronto or they're in Ottawa, and I have to be away from the family too much, and it is too much. It's a difficult way to live, being away from the family so much. So I think that's the most challenging thing, is being away from family too long. The meetings get long, the days get long, and you can't go anywhere and do anything without, I mean, if you're by yourself in a hotel room, you know, if there's not a lot to do, and you want to go out and do something, and the family isn't there. But I think that, you know, later in my tenure, I started bringing my family with me. So
yeah, it doesn't quite feel like when your family's not with you, it doesn't feel the same. You go to do something, and there's something missing, eh?
Yep.
Do the kids think it's cool that you're the chief?
Well, I think so. I think that I got some older kids and I got some younger ones. So, I mean, the older ones are over it now and you know, they think it's pretty cool and everything like that. But, and my younger one, you know, she tells all her classmates she's a princess. So, I mean, she's, I think she really gets kind of a kick out of it, but
do you make them call you chief, or do you just make them call you dad?
Oh no, I would never call. I would never ever. I don't make anybody call me chief ever. I'll be quite candid about that. I think the only people I ask to tell me to call me chief, to be honest with you, are other politicians. So You know, the mayor is according to protocol should be calling me chief. The prime minister, the premier, the ministers, they should all be calling me chief, because I call them minister, right? So it's a sign of respect. And I think that in those situations, I ask them to do that. But in most situations, you could call me whatever. If you want to call me chief.
I was excited. Like when you told me you were chief, I was like, this is great. I'm so excited for you. And I was excited. I was like, oh, Chief Jason, wow, this is kind of neat. So yeah. I was excited. I was excited that you had that that title and that honor. Look, we've touched on some really cool subject matter here. As we bring this thing home a little bit, I usually like to end things off with, you know, a little bit of fun, maybe something along the lines of rapid fire. I throw out a word or two, and then I say, well, you know, what's the first thing that comes to mind, or what do you, you know, a feeling that you want to share with us about it. You up for that?
Yeah, let's give it a try.
Okay. So I got a few things here. I'm going to start with our high school, St. Mary's College.
Oh, cross-country team. I was on the cross-country team for almost every year I was there. So
you know
that's what? That's the first thing it reminds me of.
When you said that, I lost all of our I had yearbooks and I lost them in a flood. You were in a few of those yearbooks, I think, running. I remember some of the pictures.
And I do. Yeah, I was.
Do you have them? Do you have those pictures still?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, that's awesome.
I have a few of them. Yeah.
See, so I am remembering correctly. Okay, Algoma University.
Oh, Deb Woodman. She was one of my sociology professors. She was absolutely awesome.
I went there too when I first got out of St. Mary's. I ended up going there for the first year, and it was a good school. I really liked it. Okay, something controversial here, okay? Or maybe not. Washington Redskins or the Cleveland Indians?
Oh, inappropriate?
Are you
culturally inappropriate, I suppose?
Are you glad that Washington dropped the name?
Yes. Of course, I think that I think the original name. I think you know. I think it wouldn't be as well received if it was called the Washington Caucasians.
It makes sense, right? Okay.
Or the Cleveland Crackers.
Okay. Last one. Dramatic arts.
Oh, Helen Forge. Like I said, one of my favorite teachers, very kind-hearted lady, and I miss having her, you know, around to chat with. She's around, but I mean, it'd be nice to be able to grab a coffee with her every once in a while.
She was a life teacher, eh? Like, she imparted on us some very, very life teaching moments. Is there anything that brings that the rapid fire to an end? Is there anything you want to say in closing, Jason?
Sure, I did want to mention that we did settle, like I said, in 2018. Our reserve, we have a reserve in between Chapel and Wawa, up Highway 651, probably about 50 kilometers up there. We just got a new reserve up there. We got a financial settlement. Our reserve is, we have a population of 500 members. It seems like we have 5,000, but we only have 500 members.
Wow.
And we just settled for $150 million for our reserve and for the betterment of our community and the future of our community with the federal government.
That is phenomenal. That is phenomenal news. You must be very proud.
Well, it's a lot of work, right? Like, I mean, the people I work with joke around with me all the time because I'm always looking for the next mountain to climb.
You know what? Thinking back, and I that doesn't surprise me. It doesn't. All right. Well, listen, I want to thank you for your time. I want to thank you for educating us a little bit more and helping us learn. And, you know, maybe we can touch base again somewhere down the road and get some other updates and see what else is going on. I want to thank you, Jason Goche, Chief of the Missinaube Cree First Nation, right?
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Jason.
No worries.
So hopefully you enjoyed that segment with Jason Goche, the chief of the Missinaube Cree First Nation. I certainly learned a lot having that conversation with him, and then hopefully you did too. I want to switch gears now, and last podcast I started introducing some music, and it was really to focus on some of the amazing talent that we have in Ontario or across Canada and share that with you, mostly in the spirit of when I, and I spoke about Stuart McLean last podcast, when I used to go see Stuart, he would always introduce me to some new music, and his focus was always around Canadian talent. And I really liked that he did that. And so I wanted to continue that for as long as I decide to do this podcast. So today I wanted to introduce to you to a band called Johnson's Creek Band. They are a band that I came across a couple of years ago at a live event in Richmond Hill, Ontario. Country band. They sound really crisp, but really dirty. If you can imagine what that means in terms of you know, an old country sound. The track that we're going to feature today is called "Light Up the Honky Tonk," and you know, if you have a careful listen to the lyrics. You know, Mike from the band says that it's a homage to the founding artists of country and rebel country. And I think it's true. I think when you have a listen, it does do that. You know, they envisioned when they did this, smoke-filled bars, sawdust dance floors, and people just getting rowdy on Friday and Saturday nights. He says that, you know, if you think about it, it was almost written as a rebellion song to the direction of where country music has been going in the last little while. They wanted to bring back some of the roadhouse country to the forefront. I think they've done that with this song. It's a pretty cool little tune. I'm going to give you the website information for them as well, johnsonscreekband.com, in the podcast notes. And you're going to find in there some additional songs that you can stream and have a listen to and maybe even pick up. I know I picked up their CD. I'm still a CD in hand kind of guy, and there's some really, really great other tunes on there. One of my other favorites is Ocean Fantasy, so if you get a chance, have a listen to that. All right, enough of me talking. Let's get to a little bit of music.
Break the lock of a rusted chain, push through those swinging doors. It almost smells secrets rising up through gypsum floors. There's a jukebox in the corner with writing on the side. For a good song, son, play number 51. You know a country boy can't survive. A country boy can't survive. Across the room, there's a lonesome stage where legends came to play. They made us laugh and they made us cry while we drank our blues away. If you listen close, you can almost hear Johnny sing, I'll walk the line. Let's raise a glass and flip the switch to that neon open sign. Come on, Johnny, walk the line. The honky-tonk, yeah, turn that music up loud. Saddle up that buggy and bronc and watch them hit the ground. Belly up to the bar and do Jack Daniels proud. Light up the honky-tonk and bring country back around. Up the stool and he wanna lose. I got one more thing to say. Folks who come back around just to hear those songs today. Let's raise a glass to those kicking ass who can ride a hurting song. You felt the sting of a Tennessee whiskey. Lord bless old George Jones. God bless old George Jones. Light up the honky-tonk, yeah, turn that music up loud. Saddle up those buggy bronks and a wash the ground. Yeah. To the power do Jack Daniels proud. Light up the honky tonk and bring country back around. Light up, light up, light up the honky tonk. Light up, light up, light up the honky tonk. Light up, light up. Light up the honky tonk. Light up, light up, light up the honky tonk. Light up the honky tonk, yeah, turn that music up loud. Saddle up those buggy bronks and watch them hit the ground. Belly up to the bar and do Jack Daniels proud.
That's a pretty rocking tune. You gotta love it. I love it. It just brings the energy right up. And again, I can't wait to see these guys live again as Johnson's Creek Band. They are a premier country rock band from South Central Ontario. As they say, the music is fresh. They draw inspiration from legends like Cash, Haggard, Williams, and the lyrical styling of the Roadhammers and Blackjack Billy. They describe their music, and their fans do, as Southern country rock or redneck rock and roll. And I think it sounds fresh, and I think it sounds really fantastic. So again, looking forward to their live music. But in the meantime, they do tell me that they're working on an upcoming release in the coming months of some new music. And so we can watch for that. I will include in the podcast notes their official band page, their Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Spotify. So thank you again to Johnson's Creek Band for providing that that listening experience to us, and we wish the band the best. All right, we're going to hit the reset button after that rockin' tune. We're going to get a little bit more serious again. We've got Renata Solsky joining us, and she's going to talk to us about her COVID-19 experience from having contracted it, getting through it, and what she thinks now on the other side of it as the vaccines are rolling out, not just around the world, but here in Canada as well. So have a listen and get some good information on this one. Hello, I am here with Renata Solsky, who has agreed to share with us her COVID-19 experience from having caught it with her husband and dealing with it and what the other side of it looks like. Now, as usual, in full transparency, Renata is one of my sisters, and so it's been a personal family experience that we're going to share with you. So, Renata, thank you for doing this with us, and welcome.
Thank you, Glida.
So, if we can backtrack a little bit, back in December, everybody was getting ready for their stay-at-home Christmas, right?
Yes, and we were doing the same thing. We had no plans to have anybody here. You know, the numbers had gone up. So we were buckled down in our homes.
Right. And when you say that, you really had zero contact with anybody at that point. Like you and your husband were you were at home, and except for maybe going to get a few necessities now and then. But I understand I think you ordered quite a bit, right?
Yeah, well, we did because, you know, I have an underlying condition, and both John and I are immunocompromised. So from the beginning of this pandemic back in, you know, March 2020, we took it very seriously. I think from March to July of 2020, we did not leave home. We ordered all our groceries.
Right.
You know, there were a couple of months that we didn't even walk outside. And so, yeah, by again, the fall in December, I think December 7th was the last time I went to a grocery store, and I wore a full mask with a carbon filter and a face shield. And then after that, we were just getting groceries as a pickup. So, yes, it was a, you know, a really weird situation that we got in. As our kids say, we won the lottery, but it was the wrong lottery that we won.
So leading up to this, you're masking, you're sanitizing, you've got a very low contact ratio. Basically, you're just sustaining and buckled down in the house. But you decided that for Christmas Eve, one of our family traditions is you know, it's usually the big meal or whatever, but one of the family traditions has always been cabbage soup. And
yeah.
And you and John decided you were going to go to a local market and pick up some cabbage to make cabbage soup. Is that right?
You got it, the famous cabbage.
And so tell me about that. You went to this local market. You were all dressed up for COVID, right?
Yeah. So we pulled up to the market, and I think it was they were either closing or closing in a day. And so, you know, we pulled up and we put on our masks, and we went in, and there were two clerks. There were the two of us and one other customer in there. And the neat thing about this market is when you walk into it, it's that inside-outside sort of thing. So the whole back end of the market is open. And we were in there, I would say, for less than 5 minutes, if that. You know, I can still remember the things that we bought. We bought the Christmas cabbage. We bought the Christmas broccoli. And I think I bought some beets, because, you know, that's a tradition with us, too. We broke the beets. And that was it. And we got into the car, and the first thing we do when we get in the car is we sanitize our hands before we take our masks off, and then we take our masks off, and we sanitize our hands again, and we drove home.
So before you went to this market, did you stop anywhere else?
That day, no. We normally don't. I had delivered some Christmas baking, but I had already done that. But again, it was no contact. I had baking dishes that I made for some of our friends here, and I left them on the doorstep.
Right. So you didn't stop anywhere on the way there, and you didn't stop anywhere on the way home.
No.
You're in the market for less than 5 minutes. It sounds like there's some level of ventilation that with the outdoors. By my count, there was five people in your immediate space while you're in that store. That's all correct?
Well, there was us and three more. So two clerks,
okay,
and one customer.
Right.
Yeah,
so total of five people in the space of the market where you're at. And you're sanitizing, you got your cabbage, you head home. You're none the wiser that anything has happened at this point in time, right?
No. I mean, no, not. And so this is the 21st. This is December 21st.
Okay. So by Christmas Eve, are you feeling anything?
Christmas Eve, I had a little bit of a scratchy throat. Didn't think anything of it. Christmas Day, John and I both started sneezing. And we kind of joked, you know, we said, oh, we got COVID, and we're like, no, where
were we? I remember that.
You remember that?
Yeah, we were amongst ourselves, you know, you were joking about it and whatnot, and none of us believe this. So 24th, scratchy throat, 25th, you're sneezing. Boxing Day, 26th? Did it get worse?
Boxing Day, 26th, it was more like a cold, you know, we had what we would call the, you know, the common cold. And then it's really weird, you know, because everybody experiences different things, right, with COVID. By New Year's Eve, if you remember, we were down and out. We couldn't lift our heads out of the bed. And that's how fast then it progressed, right? And then from there, so, you know, you're going from the 21st, 7 days later is when the real symptoms start to hit. And for me, it was the exhaustion, the cough, the fever, the night sweats. Of course, for a week, we couldn't eat anything. It was, well, you didn't want to. It was a loss of appetite that we had. And it wasn't fun, but you know what? We were in denial even at that point. We were like, oh, this just must be like a bad sort of a cold that we got, right? And until it was January 2nd, and when the establishment just closed on Facebook that they had cases, which they knew about December 26th, that we thought, oh my, we may have COVID. We better go get tested.
So the place ends up telling folks that they've had an outbreak several days before. And possibly while you had visited it.
Yeah, but by this time, think of the time that's gone by. From
right.
December 21st, and they don't disclose till January 2nd.
Right.
Yeah.
So when did you? So New Year's Eve, I remember, because you were both like quite lethargic and tired, and we joked around even then that,
yeah,
oh, you're just getting old and those sorts of things, that, you know, the regular stuff that brothers and sisters bug each other about, I guess. But after the 31st, you started to feel more exhausted and you were starting to get sweats and chills and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, we did. It was, we had that for, I would say, a good, from the 29th, you know, the New Year's Eve or the 30th. Yeah, I think there's 30 days,
yeah.
30th to about, we started to pick up again around January, I would say it was the 14th or 15th. So it was a couple of weeks.
But you got tested before the 4th. Like, you got tested after the 2nd, right?
So what happened on the 2nd, when they disclosed, we wanted to get tested. But it took 5 days to get tested. We didn't get tested till the 6th. So, four days, because we, you know, January 2nd, right? So, it was January 6th. When we got tested, we didn't get the test results back as positive until the 10th. And our local public health didn't call us till the 15th here. And so by then, and even, you know, my biggest frustration was, once I put it into the app, even on the, as soon as I got my, my positive test result, I tried to go into the famous app that we have, and I put it in, and they said, well, it's more than 14 days, so it doesn't enter, because you know, I guess there's a limit on the amount of days. And I thought to myself, it's a good thing we didn't see anybody else, because if we would have seen people, how would they have done contact tracing through the app, or even public health calling us on the 15th? By then,
so
it was too late.
What was the
contact anybody?
What was the call from public health on the 15th? What was that for?
Well, you know what? They were, I mean, they're very thorough, right? They go through different things with you and, you know, what you can and can't do and how are you feeling now. But the biggest thing, you know, they said, well, you know, you're over your quarantine. You can go out now. And I was like, well, where would I go? Well, no, you know, if you need to go to the store and that, because I guess they are worried, right? Because people don't understand that if you have it, you have to stay put at home, right? But at that point, we were still so sick, you know, to go anywhere, even to pick up a grocery order, right?
But you didn't get tested until the 6th.
We didn't get tested until the 6th, yeah.
And on the 6th, on the 6th, it came back positive. Sorry, on the 6th, you got tested, but on the 10th, you got your results that it was a positive test.
Exactly. It took another 4 or 5 days, right? Almost 5 days for the results to come in, yeah.
And then 5 days after that, the 15th, public health says, hey, you're clear, you can go out, and you're not infecting anybody else.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, they apologize, and I do understand. They are so overwhelmed, and especially in this district, right? But it just hit me then. I mean, it's just nothing bad. It hit me that certain things in all our provinces and in Canada probably aren't working through no fault of anybody. We just didn't expect this pandemic to hit us the way it did. But then at that point, I thought, oh my God, even the, you know, the establishment disclosing on the 2nd, you know, it took them a while, right, to gather all their information. So I think this is where maybe we could have had less people infected through it all. I don't know, but I was just like, wow, this is way too long between the time you can have a test, you get your results, and then somebody contacts you.
So
right?
Are you in the Windsor Essex district?
I am.
Yeah, right.
And we are a hot zone. Hot.
So you got your thing on the 15th, but there's a whole bunch of days in there. Were you worried?
You know what, Guido? You just go through the motions. I didn't have time to worry. When we were very sick, John and I were both sleeping in separate bedrooms. But I said to John, we kept the light out here in the hallway, well, in the entrance. And I said, if I get up and something is wrong, I'm going to just hit something really hard on the floor. And I said, you know, I will unlock the door. That way, if you can't get up, the ambulance can get here and pick me up, right?
Right.
So,
like, that's serious. You guys got to the point where you're making plans on, hey, what if one of us is unresponsive? Or, like, for it to get to that point, there must have been worry, and there must have been concern, or the symptoms must have gotten pretty severe.
Well, my temperature spiked to probably about 103 at times, and you know, I had the cough. I had it much worse than John. He had different symptoms. But yeah, I just didn't know, because I mean, there wasn't a lot of information out there. And at that point, when you're really sick, you're not going to sit there on computer and try to read through symptoms and what to do, right?
Right.
So
I mean, you weren't eating, you weren't talking, you were sleeping or trying to sleep, or.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm not a very big person. I normally weigh like, you know, 125 pounds. Well, with COVID, I had gotten down to 115 at one point.
So, public health called you on the 15th. At what point did you think, I'm coming out of this, we're going to be okay?
I remember, because it was on Rolly's birthday. By January 21st, I would say, back to, you know, eating the 3 meals a day, you know, and having more of an appetite. You know, we never lost our taste of, our sense of, sorry, taste or smell. It just, we had no appetite. And the other thing was, I didn't even have the energy, Guido, to come into the kitchen here and put on the kettle for tea.
Right.
I just couldn't.
So I guess there wasn't a whole lot of eating going on. The kitchen was closed, right?
So
that's interesting, because the 21st was almost a month from the day that you went into the establishment to do your shopping.
And I never thought of that, yeah.
And the 21st is almost a month that you went through all of that and then came out of it. Now, that's January 21st. We're almost a couple of months past that. Has there been any lingering effect?
Well, with me, because I had I had a really bad cough with COVID, and I pulled the whole left side of my, just where the ribs are, the muscle, right? So that just healed, I would say, a couple of weeks ago. So it took its toll on me that way. But other than that, no, we are back to, you know, high energy and, you know, our appetites are back, and there's no more fever or night sweat, thank God.
You still leave the light on just in case in between the rooms, or? I'm kidding.
No, we're back to one bedroom, right. And no lights are on, but yeah, well, I know. When I think back on that, you're right. I didn't even think of that, but here we are planning for something to happen, right?
I'm glad that we can joke about it now, Renata. So you've come out of it, but it's really been about a 3-month recovery for what you know today. I know that there's things out there that they say, well, people still don't know the long-term effects and things like that, after having experienced something quite scary. Like, I mean, something that, you know, 365 days ago, this weekend, you know, we all went into some sort of lockdown and we didn't have a lot of information, and it went from the TV screen, to you, like, to actually being part of those numbers and being part of the statistics that get announced of people who have been impacted by COVID-19. But here we are a year later, and there's 7 vaccines out there. I think 4 have been approved for use in Canada. There's a lot of conversation, you know, out there in terms of, do I get it? Do I not get it? I don't know this because I'm not a doctor, but there's the whole idea of, you know, you may have antibodies, you may not have antibodies, but do you still get the vaccine? Like, have you guys talked about that?
Yes, we have, and spoken to our, you know, our healthcare providers, and I have been pro this vaccine since the beginning that they started to talk about it, because, you know, anything that's going to alleviate me going to a hospital or dying, I'm for it, and plus, then, you know, you're helping everybody else around you, so, We have spoken, and yes, we are waiting to get the vaccine. Of course, because of my immunocompromised system, I do want the one with the higher efficacy rate. But I think we're lucky here now that, you know, we are getting all these vaccines coming in. So definitely the vaccine is in our near future, and I can't wait to get it.
So you sound a little bit selective of which one you want, but does it matter? Like, will you just get the first one that's available?
Like I said, I they're all good, you know, and they've been all recommended. It's just some have been tested more and others not, and I don't follow any of these, like, oh, don't take this because it does that. I'm just looking at efficacy rates, and because of me, with my underlying condition, they don't even know. And again, you know, when you look at an efficacy rate, that's based on so many things, right? So, but if we're looking at one with 90-some versus one with a 60% rate, right? I mean, I don't know how my immune system would even act to that if it's going to, help. In that way, the only thing I do know that is any vaccine I will get will prevent, you know, me from death or getting it so severe that, you know, you're going to have to go to the hospital. And, you know, having said that, people said to me, oh, well, you know, you survived COVID, and I heard that some of the symptoms, you know, are so mild. And I say to people, man, if that was a mild case, I surely wouldn't want the full-blown anything, right? So we're just, you know, they're just another way to keep everybody safe. And definitely, I really do believe in the vaccine, and everybody should get vaccinated.
So does it change what you do moving forward? Like, so you had taken all the precautions, and you still got some form of it that knocked you out. But does it change what you do, or like once you're vaccinated, or then over the course of the next, like, is it in the back of your mind now? Like, when you go out thinking I did everything right the first time, has it created any anxiety or anything like that?
Oh, big time. I have a lot of anxiety. I just this week, I walked down to the corner and back wearing a mask outside of my house here, and there's nobody out there. But definitely, the one thing the vaccine is going to do is, because I thought I'm following everything and I still contracted COVID. So one thing the vaccine will do is, I mean, I will still wear a mask and I will still follow all the public health procedures, social distancing, et cetera. But at least it's going to relieve me of that anxiety of I'll catch it again. Because if I do, it'll, you know, even with the vaccine, right, it'll be less than the symptoms that I had before. So.
Well, it's an interesting journey. You know, my intention to get you on the podcast initially was that we would talk more about your blogging and your recipes and the hobby that you have there. So hopefully, you know, you can come back and we can still do that on another segment. But I wanted to take this experience that you had and share it with others so that they understand, you know, like in terms of how easy you caught it, even with all the precautions, but even just the experience itself and the symptoms and the journey. And if, you know, if they're out there and they've caught it, if they can relate to something and whatnot. So I appreciate that you shared your story with everybody in that, and that you will come back and do a recipe blog conversation with me. Does that sound okay?
Oh, definitely. Because I am back in this kitchen cooking again, and
awesome.
Yeah, and thank you, Guido, because, you know, I think it's just like everything else. If we, the more we talk about it and share our experiences, if we can help anybody with it or help them go through it, or maybe even prevent,
right,
you know, it happening, then that's a good thing. That's a good thing. That's giving back to community, and that's what life is all about.
Renata, thank you so much for your time and for sharing the story, and we'll catch up real soon.
Okay, thanks.
All right.
Have a great evening.
Take
Bye.
Care. Bye. And now, before we get into our last segment of the podcast, which is my story, a quick word from recipesatmytable.com.
Recipes at My Table is a work of family, love of food, and sharing of stories. The stories keep the memories alive and make every day a party in my kitchen. Join me for the sharing of traditional Italian recipes and so much more. Visit me at www.recipesatmytable.com.
All right, we've come to the part of the podcast where I like to share with you some sort of story of something I've either experienced or know someone to have experienced that might impart some sort of life lesson, or perhaps even create some humor to make you chuckle or connect to some other story that you might relate to it. So today I want to tell you about an experience I had when I was about 15 years old. I was working at a Dairy Queen on Queen Street in Sault Ste. Marie, and the location was a smaller Dairy Queen. It was located not far from the Greyhound bus terminal. I don't think Greyhound's up there in the Sioux anymore, but back then it was not that far away from there. And because of that, you know, we'd get guests from that would travel through the town or whatever, and sometimes they'd be interesting folks. On this particular day, I had a couple of interesting experiences that I'll share with you. The first one, and it was somebody who came off the bus, because he told me, hey, I just got off the bus. And interestingly enough, he even told me, I got off the bus, I'm traveling up here, through here, just came up from Toronto. But that wasn't the interesting part. The interesting part is that he wanted to have a conversation with me about where he might find drugs. And again, being 15, relatively naive at the time, I had no idea where he can go and get drugs. But he was pretty adamant. He wanted to convince me that he was not a narc, and that you know, it was on the up and up, and he just needed something to hold him over for whatever reasons that might be. But that wasn't the interesting part of the day. That was sort of the prelude to the next part. That, you know, after the guy left, realizing that I was had no information for him or was not going to help him, would not serve his purpose, another fellow came in. And the other fellow comes in and he leans on the counter. And I said, yeah, sir, can I help you? What can I get you today, sort of thing, you know, the pleasantries. And he doesn't say anything to me, but he leans on the counter and he's got his head on his hand, you know, on and the elbow on the counter. He's kind of leaned over and he's looking at me. And I'm thinking, okay, he must be thinking, right? So I wait a few seconds, and before I can get out the next, sir, can I help you with anything? He takes the Smarty container, because we had all the Blizzard containers all lined up on the counter. He takes the Smarty container and he turns it around and he reaches into it with his hand, takes a handful, opens his mouth, slams them in, starts chewing, spitting Smarties all over the place. And I, as he's doing this, I'm thinking to myself, what is he doing? And at some point, sir, I'm sorry, you can't do that. And he looks at me and in mid-chew belches. A whole bunch of Smarties go flying all over the place. This is pretty disgusting, I know. But a whole bunch of Smarties go flying all over the place. And now I'm looking at the guy going, sir, I'm sorry, you can't do this. And I could barely get the words out. He grabs the whole Smartie container and runs out the door with the Smartie container. I got Smarties all over the place. I got a guy who stole the Smarties, and I'm thinking, what do I do? Like, I'm not going to go chase this guy for Smartie containers. So I call the owner who's working at the other location, and I tell them what's just happened. And they say, well, you didn't stop him from taking the Smarties? I'm like, he grabbed it and ran. And they're like, well, where is he? I don't know. He ran down the street. I'm not going to go chasing the guy. I lock up the store and go chasing a guy with a canister of Smarties down the street. So I said, well, what do you want me to do? And they said, well, call the police. Okay. So I make a phone call to the police. And now, so this is around the time when Smarties run in their campaign of who stole the blue Smarties or something like that, or where did the blue Smarties go? For some reason, the blue Smarties were missing, and it was a Smarties campaign. And so I'm telling the police the entire story, and the desk sergeant or the receiving sergeant says to me, I kid you not, she says, did they steal just the blue ones? And I'm thinking to myself, I just got robbed of Smarties canister here. and you guys are joking around about it. But in retrospect, even then, it was funny. No, they didn't just steal the blue ones. They took the whole canister. So they promised me they're going to dispatch somebody to look after this. And I'm thinking, okay. Anyways, they do. And within about an hour, a couple of officers come back to the store and they're holding this glass canister with Smarties in it. And they say, hey, yeah, we caught the guy. I'm like, really? Where was he? Oh, he had taken off down Queen Street and he was sitting on the curb eating the Smarties. I'm like, all right, well, that's great. At least he was enjoying the Smarties, it sounds like. Yeah, yeah, here you go, right? So I don't know what they ended up doing with the guy. I did throw out the Smarties and disinfected the Smarties canister probably, I don't know, three times before I refilled it and put it back out. But that is my story on who stole not just the blue Smarties, but the entire canister of Smarties. So listen, folks, protect your Smarties, especially during COVID-19. Hope you had a chuckle there, and thanks for listening. That brings to conclusion, everybody, our March 2021 podcast. Hopefully everybody found something of interest in it, from information to some fun. I'm going to close things off, if you stuck around long enough to listen to the end, with a little bit from one of my original tunes called Restitution. See you in April, folks.